That's it, right there, thank you. Okay, so last week we kind of started, Caleb got us into 1 Peter here, the beginning of Peter's epistles, with an introduction for us. And so I'm going to not really do a whole lot of review on that, but really just jump right in. And the one thing that I do that he mentioned that I want to bring up right now as we go to dive into the things that Peter is saying as he kind of starts this letter is, so where we started was, and this is what we talked about last week, was we have, from the onset, we have a greeting, and the greeting, and that is not dark. Do you have something else? The greeting is to who?
Or whom,
I should say. Very beginning, go look at the chapter 1. Who is he sending this greeting? Not specifically, there's places mentioned, but he says, greetings to, you guys know it's my favorite term.
Who? Exiles.
Exiles, right? And it's easy to remember because it's the elect exiles, if you're reading the ESV. E-E, elect exiles. And the character of these, or to qualify who he's talking about, he says, in all of these places, I'm talking to you, the elect exiles, meaning the ones who are chosen. And it's the one who are chosen, when you're chosen or you're elected, it's, and this is what Caleb talked about last week, it's with a purpose in mind. And so he tells us that there is a purpose that's in mind, and it is sanctification, which is that big word that really means to be set apart or to be made holy. And so you have been set apart, and it's for the purpose of, and you see that in verse 3, I think, what's the purpose that's in mind? You have been sanctified for, that's it, obedience, for, I'll just say for purity, the sprinkling by the blood. All right, so this is who we're talking to. He says he sends greetings, the elect exiles. So already this is telling us something about what's going on here. We're talking about this category of people who don't have a home, who have been chosen, which is kind of hard to reconcile. Really? I'm chosen, but I don't have a home? Like, how is that? But I'm set apart. I've been made holy because for the purpose of obedience. Not because of my obedience, but for the purpose of obedience and purity. And then he says, according to his great, yours may say abundant, mercy. Da, da, da. Now, this is where Caleb took us when he was kind of framing up the book in its entirety. If you go to chapter 5, here's what I want you to see, is that we have a whole letter that is sandwiched in between this. From the onset, it is according to his great mercy. God is a merciful God. God is a loving God, and it's according to our Father who is blessed and his great mercy and his character that, and then things follow that we're going to talk about. And then he comes back at the very end, and he says in verse 12 of chapter 5, by Silvanus, a faithful brother as I regard him, I have written briefly to you, exhorting and declaring that this is the true grace of God. And so, gotta go down here. This is, I wish I had a nice dark black marker. This is the true grace of God. Now, so whatever is happening in between here, we start with him saying that I'm going to tell you something that is by the mercy of God, our Father. Blessed is his name. According to his grace, mercy, and then he's going to tell us some things, and then he's going to come back and say, I told you, this is why I was writing this. It's because I wanted you to know that this is the true grace of God. And saying it like that, the true grace of God, why do you think, what does that sound like? You know, that to say that there is, this is the true grace of God. What I'm kind of asking you to read my mind. But what I'm thinking about this as I see this, and hopefully this is kind of what you're thinking as well, is if he's having to tell them, I'm writing you to tell you that this is the true grace of God, it sounds like he's having to convince them of something. So there's going to be something in the middle here that is really telling them something that apparently it might be hard to believe. And like I said, if you start by telling that he's writing to exiles, when has anyone ever wanted to be an exile? Right? That doesn't sound like something that anyone would choose. Yeah, I'd love to go and be like, you know, in a place that's not my home. That sounds like a great idea. So he starts by saying that this is to the exiles. And so maybe that's why already we're getting a hint that the purpose of this letter is to tell them that this is actually God's grace. And grace in terms of, when you think of grace, it's just a big word for a gift, right? Mercy. God, he has gifted us. He has given us so much. And so as we just read, I think that you could break it down into a category here. We're going to have a box here, and we're just going to list what are the gifts that God has given. And what we'll find is that there's some things that are unexpected that show up as his grace, which is why he's probably saying, I've written because I want you to know that it is God's grace, even though you may doubt it. So we've got the grace, and then I'm just going to have a category here that I call just therefore. And this goes back to where we started when we were reading Daniel, the questions of, okay, so I'm an exile. So I'm wondering who's in charge. What is my true home? What is my identity? And what is my purpose? What am I supposed to be doing? And Peter, fortunately, is talking to exiles and he's saying, I'll tell you what you should be doing. But I want to remind you first of who you are and what all the amazing and great things that God has done for you, just in case that you're doubting it right now. If you're doubting, is this really God's plan? Is it really his grace? And so he begins in chapter 1 and he just starts to list things. And if you're not watching carefully, you may not realize that that's what he's doing. But notice the language that he keeps saying. What's the pronouns that you see frequently used in this section? Just scan it and see if you see a repeating, like, what pronoun is he using over and over again? You. You'll see that? It is for you that he did this, so that for you, so that, I mean, as an example, the prophets, he talks about the prophets, that they were prophesying in verse 10, the grace to be yours, so you and yours, so the grace, there it is, grace, the gift that is yours, and they were doing this for you. They were serving not themselves, but you in verse 12. So all of these things, that's who's in mind right now. He's saying, I'm talking to you, and I want you to know what has been done for you according to his grace mercy, because it is the true grace of God, everything that you're experiencing. And so what is it that is God's gift? This is where I need your help. So scan, go back, and let's just do the first 12 verses here. Just start in verse 3 right here. He says, according to his grace and his great mercy. What's the first thing? What has he done that we can categorize as his grace? It's a gift to us. What has he done? What does it say in verse 3?
A lively hope.
Yes. Okay, so we have not just a hope, but a living hope. Which tells me that there's a category of hope that's dying. There are things that people put their hope in, and they shouldn't. Because it's passing away. They put their hope in something that is not going to stand, that is not really something that you should hope in because it's dying. But there is a category of hope that's living. It's alive. And that's not the only thing that's alive in this verse. What else? You have a living hope, but what else? Maybe I asked that question in a confusing way, but what's the other thing that he says in this verse that has happened to us and for us? We have been made a new, you could say we have new life. I'm going to run out of room. We have
a living hope. We have new life because we've been born again. And so we are alive. We're not those who are dying. We are living. And you know who was the first that showed us and gave us a cause to believe that this is true? Well, who is it in this verse? Who was made alive first?
Jesus
himself, who was resurrected from the dead. And so we can put our hope in him. We already know what's going to happen because we've seen it in Jesus. And we're going to come back to Jesus over and over again as the means by which we can understand what grace really is. Okay, God's grace. So then in verse 4, what else do we have? And in the fact, just don't be afraid. Say it. You've got the, you can cheat. It's all right here.
Have an inheritance.
An inheritance, right? And that's, it's one of those that you can remember because it's an imperishable. Kind of like elect exile. So we have an imperishable inheritance. Similar to a living hope, think about the reverse. You could have an inheritance that's not imperishable. In fact, if you think about the Bible story, what was the inheritance that God's people were, so, I mean, when the original elect, what was the inheritance that they looked forward to? What had God promised them? What was their inheritance? Like literally.
The promised land.
It was the promised land, right? Which there's nothing wrong. It wasn't that it was a bad gift. That was God's grace as well. But you know what? What's happened to that place? Over time, you know, it's had its ups and downs as a place, but just think about that land, the specific, you know, acreage that they were promised, and think of all the history of that place, and it's perishing. And part of it is the effect that people have had on it, right? And that right now it's in a place where you don't, there's places where you wouldn't want to go because it's not safe, right? And so there is a perishable inheritance. There is a place that he's saying, that's not really your home. God has now given you a new home. He's given you a new inheritance, something to put your hope in, and it's something that's not going to be affected by humans and their evil intent, and it's not going to be affected by the corruption of this world. It is imperishable. It's unfaded. And it's kept for you, right? That's who's in mind right now. So this is all like, this has happened for you, elect exiles. And so you, let's see. Oh, wait. I don't want to skip 5. What else? You have something that is going to be revealed in the last time. What is it? Salvation? And it's salvation through what? And by the way, this is, it's like one of those nice sandwiches. We've got this big sandwich, now we have a little sandwich. Because you have salvation through what? Through faith. And then there's something that's in between, which we're going to talk about. But the end, the outer bounds of this, is salvation through faith. We started in 5. So you're being guarded for salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Guarded through faith. And then, what do you obtain in verse 9? Salvation through faith, right? The outcome of your faith is the salvation of your souls. And then he says, and regarding concerning the salvation, and then he continues. And so right in the focus right now is what salvation really is. And so it's this thing that is going to happen, that is going to be revealed, and it's going to be revealed to those who have faith, all right? But in between that, why is it that we're going to need to have faith? And think of faith like that's a Bible word, and you've probably heard me say this before if you've been in my classes, but something that was really helpful to me is that there's so much theology and there's so much that people have talked about of what is faith, that it becomes a word that is just like charged with, you know, years of just people debating what does it really mean. And so to me, it was helpful to just realize, like, faith fundamentally, and this is not going to be any kind of earth-shattering thing to you to hear this, it's what we all already know, is that it's just that I'm going to trust God. Because what we have in verse 17 is he's our Father. And so if I truly believe that he's my Father, then I believe that he has my best interest in mind, that he wants what's best for me. And so when there is something that makes me question
Does he really have my interest in mind? Is it really his great mercy? Is it really his grace that has caused all of this? Because I don't understand it, and I can't reconcile what's going on with that. This doesn't seem good to me. If I trust him, and I know he's my father, then I can just say, I don't understand it, but I trust him. And if I can do that, then I will have the salvation that's the outcome of faith. So what is it that in between the salvation sandwich is going to put that faith to the test? Look between verses 5 and 9. What is it talking about? And this is really what you think of when you think of Peter. What is he talking about? What is going to be happening to them? They're going to be tested, right? There is a testing, and we could just say, and this is one of the S, suffering. That's one of the S words that Caleb focused on, and it is one that when you think of 1 Peter, this is what most people think of. But the funny thing is so I'm putting this under the category grace. And it's really kind of like suffering, ? Really? And so I think this is where all of a sudden we realize why Peter is doing the job of convincing them. You're not yet at home. And you've been going through a test, and you're going to go through a test. And you are going to suffer. But what he's trying to say is actually, when you think of that, what I want you to think of is I want you to think of the grace of God. That this suffering actually is something that can be made into something beautiful within God's context, within his plans. And so how is it that suffering in this case is actually something that's a gift? What is he saying is happening as a result of their suffering? He uses an image. And what's the image?
Gold.
Gold. The purification process. What does it go through in order to be refined and made to be pure? That's what we're looking for. It's for the purpose of purity. It's for the purpose of obedience. And so the suffering itself is the thing that's going to put me to the test. And on the other side is I'm going to find out that my God does love me, and I love him, and I trust him. And other people are going to see that. And then they're going to know that I have a real faith. Does Job come to mind in all of this? Remember that's what Satan was trying to say to God. Was how can you say that your children, your created beings, if they really love you, if only good things ever happen to them. They don't. As soon as I take away their stuff, and as soon as I like put them through the ringer, then you'll see who they really are. And God lets that happen. Why? Because it tests the genuineness of our trust in him. And it shows a relationship that's beautiful. And when other people see it, what is going to follow suffering? And in this book, it happens that it's suffering first, but what follows? And we read it in chapter 1, that Jesus, the prophets, they prophesied about Jesus, the suffering to come, but the something to follow. What follows? You see that? Glory. All right, we saw the word glory show up so many times. And that glorification process is, again, as we go through, and I'm going to try to advance this a little bit. I've been moving very slowly. Predicted the sufferings, verse 11, the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. That was what the prophecies were. And so, if you're questioning, like, could that be? Could that be God's plan for his kingdom? Could that be God's plan for his people? That really what he's saying is that you're going to be put through a test and you are going to actually suffer. And all is not going to be immediately just God snaps his fingers and then there's no more conflict. Well, the thing that he points to is Jesus himself. And Peter, as we talked about last time, did he have trouble with this himself? Yes. He tried to talk Jesus out of the cross. He's like, that can't be God's plan. You're telling me that I just said that you're the Christ, which means that you're the king. You're the one that's going to usher in all that we've been waiting for. You're the one that is bringing about our hope and our inheritance and this new life and this new existence. And we're going home, but you're telling me that I just said all that and you're telling me you're going to go to Jerusalem to be killed? No, you're going to go to Jerusalem so you can get on your throne. And we would like 12 thrones to be right there beside you. And, you know, and let's talk about all that. I don't want to hear about your suffering. Because if you're my king and you're suffering, that means that maybe I'm going to have to go through suffering.
And it just blew Peter's mind. But apparently he figured it out. And this letter he's writing is to say, this is what I experienced. And when he thinks about suffering and when he thinks about what it can become, he thinks about Jesus and what Jesus taught him on the cross. Because on the cross, somehow, suffering, as ugly as it was, and as much shame as was supposed to be, it was designed to just completely humiliate people. But that was the moment that Jesus put on display his glory. That's where God was glorifying him. That in that moment, his love for others turned suffering into something beautiful. And it showed that he trusted his Father just all the way to death. And it made us take a second look as well. And so it was this beacon that made suffering into something beautiful. And actually, you could think of it as God's grace for mankind, right? That our experience, although it's frequently what you see in Ecclesiastes, it's hopelessness. It's this thought that, like, what am I even here for? You know, all of the things that happen, and cancer, and, I mean, war. It's hard to reconcile all of that. And so I get this, that sometimes we have to be convinced, is this really the way it's supposed to be? But think of what God can do and how he can turn suffering upside down and turn it into something beautiful. And that becomes his grace. And so, like I said, I've moved very slowly. Let's go ahead to verse 13 where we get some therefores. And that's really, I think if you put these together, what you're going to find through this letter is some things that are about what God has done and his grace, and then how am I supposed to live as a result of that. So, therefore, what do? In verse 13. Just say it. Just read it off the page here. What do?
Keep sober in spirit.
Yeah, sober-minded. We prepare our minds for action. What's the action? What's coming?
Well,
suffering. And it's going to take me being mentally ready for it. And he's saying, I'm preparing you so you know that this is the grace of God. You know that the prophets already told us this was going to happen. That's the thing, is that I didn't mention, is one of the gifts, the prophets were for you. So that when the suffering happened, that you didn't believe that God failed on his plan, you realize this is God's plan. This is his grace. And so meditate on that. Prepare your mind for action and set your hope on grace. There's grace now and there's grace that's going to be revealed. We have that. That's another thing Caleb mentioned last time, the revelation of Jesus Christ. There's a moment, and this is what's interesting about the Bible, and this is what's interesting about the kingdom, is there's things that have already happened. We have been redeemed. We have been ransomed. We have been gifted. All of these things, but there's things that we're waiting for as well. And so we live right now with the reality in mind that what we can't see, and that's the faith, is already, we already know that it's true. And so we are waiting. And so that's why there's hope. There's hope because there's something that we haven't fully realized yet. And so that's what you do. You set your hope on the grace that's coming. When all of this is going to be made right, when suffering is going to go away, it's not yet, but one day it's going to be, God is going to make everything right. He's going to balance the books and all things are going to be good. And when you think about that as heaven, when you think about what you're longing for and when it's hard to picture, you know, what is heaven going to be like? I think about that sometimes. And sometimes it makes me a little bit uneasy to think about it because I don't know how to think about an existence like that. I don't know how to think about where there's no end. You know, and as a kid, it just blew my mind. And it still blows my mind. But what I think about is if you could run this world and all that's gone wrong, suffering, if you could run it through a filter and on the other side, only the good things come through it. Only just whatever it is in your life that you know is really good. Not the things that sometimes we call good, some things that we have in our own passions, but things that are truly good. That's all that's going to be left on the other side when he makes all things new. And so that's what we set our hope on. And verse 14, unsurprisingly, he comes back to our purpose is to be obedient. Why? Because we're supposed to be holy, set apart. So, you could just say, be holy. And just saying that, you're like, how can I be holy? Like, I do things, I fail, I try really hard, but most of the time, I feel like I'm really coming short of that. I know that my Father is holy, and I want to be holy, but I fall short. And I think that Peter and Paul and all the apostles are saying, yeah, you are going to fall, and you are going to make mistakes. But know that by the blood of Christ, the sprinkling, the purity that's happening through Jesus, that this is not a standard that we should not set our minds to attain to. And so we should think of ourselves and think, I have been set apart with a purpose. I have been ransomed, as he says. We have been ransomed. If you see that word, let's see. Ransom from verse 18. We've been ransomed from futile ways. Sometimes when we think of salvation, we just think that I'm going to not have to go to hell. You realize that salvation is that I don't have to be what I was before Jesus? That the things that I chose were futile. What purpose did they serve when I was following my own passions? And it's funny because, you know, depending on when your experience and when you were baptized, it was really young. Sometimes you think in terms of like, well, I don't really remember what life was like before Jesus. You know, I've always known him and I knew him as a child. And so some of you that grew up in houses where your parents were Christians, that may be how you think. But realize that every day of your life as a Christian is going to be a growing appreciation for the... for the version of yourself that would have been if not for that day, whenever that was in your life. That you would have been on the trajectory that your flesh would have taken you on, and it would have been futile. And it would have led to destruction, and it's perishable, and all of those things that he's saying that God's grace is not. And so, by the blood of Jesus, we don't have to be that. And so, starting in chapter 2, we put off that stuff. Whatever it is, all the fleshly things, all our passions, we put it off. We want to be like our Father. And we understand that His grace is that He saved us from ourselves right now. There's some things I'm going to wait for when He's revealed. There's also things that I have right now. I don't have to be what I was. And in this town, there's a lot of worldly things that you guys can get into. Realize that that's not God's plan for you. That that's not His grace. That as long as you're following that, that you're not realizing your potential. And that He has so much better things in store for you. So stay away from that stuff. Put all of that off. And be holy because your Father is holy. And what that's going to take is faith. Just going to have to trust. That it may seem more logical to you that you're going to enjoy, I'm going to enjoy my like youth. I'm in college and all of these other people are doing this stuff. Why would I deprive myself? Why would I associate with people who are not seen as the popular ones or whatever? Why would I choose that? And it may not make sense to you. And you may think that it would be better for you to just engage in all of those things and maybe one day I'll get serious. Maybe one day I'll decide that I'll be holy. But just don't believe that lie. Every day that you have is a day like for you to start growing and being changed by God and being prepared for that existence that's going to be eternal. And it's better. And it's right now. That's God's grace for you. So, let me see. We can move into, I've missed several of the gifts here if we were just kind of inventorying verse by verse. But I want to move us into chapter 2 very quickly. In a couple minutes here, what do you see just in chapter 2? Some of the references to the Old Testament, he says, what does he say that we have become? Oh man, I can't miss this. All right, let me just bring this link together. This will probably be as far as we can get. If you have time this week, and you, I guarantee you do, read Psalm 34. Oh man, it's so cool what he's doing here. Does anybody know what Psalm 34 is about? You know, does anybody know who wrote Psalm 34?
If you know anything about the Psalms, you can guess, and you'll be right.
David, right? Okay. At a time in David's life where he was at a pretty low point, he had to pretend to be crazy so that he wouldn't be killed by some pagans. The king, as high as he had been, has come down to as low as he could be, where there were fools throwing rocks at him and running him out of his kingdom. His son, his own son, and everybody knew, had taken it from him. And at his lowest point, he writes this psalm. And you got to go read it. And it's about God being the God of the little people. And the only way that David could say that and anyone have any respect for what he was saying is think about him saying that God is good. God is a God of grace. What do you think all the people in his kingdom would say if it's just David at his highest point? What do you think some of the people, let's say just the normal people, what about the people who are poor? What about the widows? What might they say to David as the king when he says, God is good, praise him?
It's just easy for you to say because you're king.
That's right. It's easy for you to say from your lofty ivory tower. But it's from David's lowest place that he has the credibility to say, God is good, and I know it. And in that, he says, taste and see that the Lord is good. You see what Peter did there? He says, long for the spiritual milk because, why? Because you've tasted that the Lord is good. A reference to Psalm 34. Now, if you go read it, you're going to see what I'm talking about. That Peter, he has that in mind in several other passages, and it becomes his language and how he speaks. And so it's from there and from David and his words and from seeing Jesus embody that spirit, a king who had condescended and come to his lowest point and professes God's praise. I will put my confidence in him. He will deliver. And I know that the Lord is good. And so what happens in that psalm is, well, what does that mean I'm going to do? I'm going to do good. If you want to desire it, man, we have to be out of time, I think. But yeah, it looks like we don't maybe figure it out. But go read Psalm 34. And it's going to help you to put all this together, what Peter is saying. Is that he's definitely steeped in the Old Testament. There's references all in here we didn't talk about. But yeah, for your homework, go read Psalm 34. We didn't really do justice for the first 12 verses, but what we're going to do is we're going to move into the next section next week, and we'll talk about the therefore in terms of how I relate to the world around me, especially when the authority structures that be mistreat me. Like, how am I supposed to respond to that? And if you read Psalm 34, the answer is actually in there, so you should do that. All right, see y'all.
The ratio of